du jetzt eine Stimme ab. Wenn ja, dann tritt für mich ein, so wie ich für dich eingetreten bin.
May 1940. The German army surged across the Ardennes forest, a region military planners had long considered impassable for tanks. Yet within days, panzer divisions had covered distances that stunned Allied commanders. French defenses crumbled. Belgian towns fell one after another. It looked like mechanical genius, flawless coordination, and sheer willpower. But inside the pockets of those tank crews, pilots and infantrymen, was something smaller, stranger, and far more dangerous than steel or oil. A pill. White, unremarkable, stamped with the name Pervitin. Each tablet contained methamphetamine, and the German high command had ordered millions of them. To many soldiers, it felt like magic. Fatigue vanished, hunger dulled, fear dissolved. They could march 36 hours without stopping, fight through the night, and push machinery beyond its limits. Blitzkrieg, lightning war, was fueled not just by gasoline, but by chemistry. This is the hidden story of drugs in the Second World War, a story that runs deeper than German meth pills. The Allies had their own cocktails. Benzedrine for bomber crews, morphine for medics, and rum rations stretching back generations. In field hospitals, stimulants and sedatives blurred the lines between healing and exploitation. In the concentration camps, chemical experiments turned into instruments of cruelty. And in Hitler's inner circle, narcotics played a sinister role in decisions that reshaped the world. We tend to imagine the war as a clash of tanks, planes, and ideologies. But behind the battlefield strategies was a quieter, chemical war fought inside human bodies. Drugs did not invent fascism, they did not create genocide. But they stripped away hesitation, suppressed exhaustion, and in some cases, magnified violence by removing the last human breaks. In this documentary, we follow the journey of wartime drugs, from laboratory benches to factory production, from civilian counters to frontline rations, from the dictator's private doctor to the exhausted soldier stumbling through rubble. We will see how chemistry accelerated victories and collapses. And we will confront the question, what happens when entire nations lean on pills to sustain impossible wars? Because in the end, the story of drugs in World War II is not just about soldiers marching without sleep. It is about the price of treating people as machines, about what happens when science is bent to ideology, and about the haunting echoes that still linger in medicine, the military, and society today. The real fuel of the Second World War wasn't just oil. It was chemical, and its consequences did not stop when the fighting ended. Now, let's go back to where the pill first appeared. Berlin's 1937. In a quiet laboratory tucked into the industrial sprawl of the German capital, chemists at the Temmler Pharmaceutical Company finalized a process that would ripple across the world. They had refined a crystalline powder into a pill. Small, white, easy to swallow. Its name, Pervitin. Its active ingredient, methamphetamine hydrochloride. To the scientists, it was chemistry. To the public, it was a promise. Temmler's marketing arm wasted no time turning this discovery into a consumer product. Within months, Berlin newspapers carried advertisements showing modern housewives smiling over steaming pots, students bent diligently over textbooks, businessmen shaking hands with newfound vigor. A stimulant for work and play, the slogan suggested. The 1930s were an age of optimism for pharmaceutical solutions. Antibiotics were just emerging. Vitamins and hormones filled pharmacy shelves. The idea that chemistry could improve daily life was not only accepted, it was celebrated. Pervitin was marketed as part of this culture of progress. Doctors, too, embraced it. Prescriptions for fatigue, depression, or simple lack of energy were common. A university dissertation even hailed pervitin as a scientific marvel for the modern workforce. In fact, it was so normalized that some reports suggest bakeries in Berlin experimented with pervitin pralines, chocolates allegedly laced with methamphetamine, marketed to help women power through housework, though their prevalence remains debated. The boundaries between medicine, confection, and narcotics blurred. Methamphetamine itself was not a German invention. In 1919, Japanese chemist Akira Ogata synthesized it from ephedrine, which had long been used in Asian medicine as a decongestant and stimulant. The compound was more potent than amphetamine, which American chemist Gordon Allis had synthesized a decade earlier. By the 1930s, both substances were being tested in Europe and the United States. What Temler did differently was industrialize it. They created a pill cheap to make, stable to store, and easy to distribute. By 1938, the German market was saturated with pervitin. Doctors wrote prescriptions in the tens of thousands. Office clerks took it before long shifts. Drivers popped it before overnight hauls. Students relied on it during exams. Housewives stirred it into coffee before tackling laundry. It seemed harmless, almost wholesome. Meanwhile, in Britain and the United States, another drug followed a similar path. Benzedrine, the trade name for amphetamine sulfate, had been introduced in 1932 by the American pharmaceutical company Smith, Kline & French. At first, it came as an inhaler for nasal congestion, but doctors quickly noticed its stimulating effect. By 1937, pill forms were available by prescription. Like pervitin, benzedrine was marketed widely for depression, obesity, low blood pressure, even seasickness. American newspapers printed cheerful ads promising pep pills for tired workers. College students began using them for late-night study. By the eve of World War II, both Germany and the Allies had stimulant pills circulating through ordinary civilian life. It's important to pause here. These drugs did not enter the world as sinister tools of war. They were legal, medicalized, and normalized. They sat in kitchen cupboards and office desks long before they reached military rations. This normalization is crucial. It meant that when the war erupted, governments faced little cultural resistance to adapting them for soldiers. In Nazi Germany, pervitin's rise coincided with a regime obsessed with efficiency, vitality, and the transformation of ordinary citizens into instruments of the state. Hitler's ideology extolled the virtues of discipline and willpower, yet behind the rhetoric, chemistry offered a shortcut. By 1938, German doctors were already publishing studies recommending pervitin for soldiers. One military physiologist, Dr. Otto Ranke, conducted experiments showing that methamphetamine could keep men awake for 36 to 50 hours without catastrophic decline. He concluded it was the perfect tool for the Wehrmacht. The pill fit the doctrine of blitzkrieg or lightning war. Success depended on speed, surprise, and relentless pressure. Fatigue was the enemy of velocity. Pervitin appeared to solve this. But from 1937 to 1939, this was still speculation. Soldiers hadn't yet swallowed the pill in mass numbers. That moment would come when Hitler unleashed war on Poland in September 1939.
Hitler flies to survey what he has done, the destruction of a nation. Poland divided between the Nazi Germans and the Soviets.
Even before the military took over, signs of danger emerged. Doctors began reporting cases of dependency among ordinary citizens. Students collapsed after exam weeks, unable to sleep. Housewives suffered mood swings and depression when they stopped. A Berlin doctor noted that patients described a crash after the drug wore off, profound exhaustion and irritability. Yet these warnings were drowned out by the enthusiasm of a society intoxicated by speed. In a regime that worshipped productivity, complaints were often dismissed as weakness. By the late 1930s, Germany was consuming millions of Pervitin tablets per year. The infrastructure for wartime distribution was already in place. Across the Channel, British and American militaries took note. Reports of German civilian use circulated in medical journals. In 1938, the British Royal Air Force conducted limited trials of Benzedrine on pilots during training exercises. Results were mixed but promising. Men stayed alert longer, though they later reported agitation. In the United States, the Army Medical Corps quietly stockpiled Benzedrine tablets even before America entered the war. By 1940, military research papers openly discussed their value in prolonged duties requiring vigilance. Both sides were preparing, whether consciously or not, to carry stimulants from the pharmacy counter to the battlefield. The leap was disturbingly short, a substance that powered exam cramming and late-night housework in 1937 would, by 1940, propel tanks through the Ardennes and bombers over the English Channel. What makes this history chilling is not just the chemistry. It is the normalization. The pill felt ordinary before it was weaponized. By the time governments ordered millions of tablets, no one saw them as shocking. They were already part of life. And so, when Hitler's armies rolled into Poland and then into France, their pockets were filled not only with ammunition and rations, but with small white pills. The laboratory had created the pill. Civilian life had normalized it. The military would now weaponize it. But how exactly did a box of tablets become an official instrument of Blitzkrieg? How did a doctor's prescription transform into a logistical order for millions? The answer lies in 1939 to 1940, when the Wehrmacht made Pervitin a tool of strategy. And when that happened, the war itself began to accelerate. To understand that acceleration, we must step into the spring of 1940, into the chemistry of Blitzkrieg. September 1st, 1939. At dawn, German forces rolled into Poland. The first great clash of World War II had begun. To the world, it looked like military genius. Tanks advancing in tight coordination, dive bombers screaming down on columns of refugees and soldiers alike, infantry pushing faster than defenses could form. The Blitzkrieg, lightning war, had arrived. But inside the Wehrmacht's field orders was something unusual. Something the enemy couldn't see. A pill. As Hitler prepared to invade Poland, his generals faced a problem: how to keep men moving across vast distances without collapse. Armies were still powered by human stamina. Horses pulled supply carts. Soldiers marched on foot. Fatigue was inevitable. But German military doctors had already been studying a solution. Dr. Otto Ranke, director of the Institute for General and Defense Physiology, had tested methamphetamine on university students. His findings were astonishing. Subjects stayed awake for days, completing tasks without complaint, their performance apparently intact. Ranke was convinced this was the key to modern warfare. In his 1939 report, he wrote, "It is a valuable substance for the reduction of need for sleep. It can contribute significantly to the success of military operations." So when the Wehrmacht mobilized, supply officers slipped Pervitin into the logistics chain. Soldiers on the move in Poland were given small white tablets along with rations and ammunition. At first, the scale was limited, but the results, swift advances, little rest required, relentless tempo, caught the attention of commanders. It was in the campaign against France in the spring of 1940 that stimulants shifted from experiment to doctrine. The invasion plan was bold. Panzer divisions would thrust through the Ardennes, a dense, hilly forest the Allies considered impassable for tanks, and then race west to the Channel, cutting off French and British forces. The strategy depended on speed, surprise, and unbroken momentum. Any pause could give the enemy time to regroup. To sustain such a pace, fatigue had to be eliminated. Orders went out, distribute Pervitin in mass quantities. Estimates suggest that by April 1940, approximately 35 million tablets had been shipped to German units preparing for the offensive, though exact figures vary due to incomplete records. The pill now had official nicknames. For tank crews, it was Panzer Schokolade, tank chocolate. For Luftwaffe pilots, Stuka tablets, after the terrifying dive bombers that screamed over French towns. To the ordinary infantryman, it was simply a lifeline, the difference between keeping up with the panzers or falling behind. Reports from the field read like science fiction. One division recorded marching 80 kilometers in 36 hours with almost no rest. Soldiers described a strange clarity, as if exhaustion had been switched off. "We are moving like machines," one wrote in a letter home. In the air, Luftwaffe pilots flew mission after mission, sometimes 12 hours at a stretch, without collapse. In diaries, some admitted they barely remembered the landings. The body moved automatically, the mind detached. From the Allied perspective, the German advance seemed unstoppable. British officers watched in disbelief as German columns pushed through terrain they thought would slow them for weeks. "They appear tireless," one French report complained. "No pause, no hesitation." To outside observers, it looked like discipline. Inside the ranks, it was chemistry. But the miracle came with costs. Medical memos from 1940 already noted disturbing side effects. Soldiers grew irritable, reckless, or euphoric to the point of ignoring orders. Some reported hallucinations, phantom enemies, imagined movements in the forest. Others collapsed into sudden, deep sleep when the drug wore off. Sometimes in the middle of a march, sometimes while manning critical positions. One divisional doctor recorded, "After three doses, behavior becomes unpredictable. Aggression rises, judgment impaired. The cycle was simple and dangerous. Surge, crash, surge again." For a doctrine built on relentless momentum, that crash could be catastrophic. The Allies took notice. Intelligence reports by 1940 suggested that German soldiers were being chemically assisted. British scientists experimented with their own stimulant, benzedrine, already on the civilian market. By the summer of 1940, the Royal Air Force officially authorized its use on long missions. The US Army, not yet in the war, conducted tests of benzedrine on troops during field exercises. Results mirrored the German experience. Men stayed alert but showed poor judgment under strain. Despite this, by 1941, benzedrine was a standard issue for American bomber crews preparing for the inevitable conflict. Thus, a new kind of arms race began, not of steel or oil, but of chemistry. The German victories in 1940 stunned the world. Denmark and Norway in April, France and the Low Countries in May and June. Within weeks, Paris had fallen. By midsummer, only Britain stood unoccupied. The myth of Blitzkrieg was born, the image of unstoppable German forces, perfectly coordinated, always one step ahead. Historians often credit planning, technology, and the element of surprise, and rightly so. But buried beneath the strategy was another factor. Millions of white tablets swallowed in the dark, pushing human bodies past their natural limits. It's worth repeating, the pill did not invent the invasion, but it removed the last brake on speed. Blitzkrieg was not only tanks and radios, it was chemistry. Even in 1940, cracks were visible. Soldiers complained of exhaustion once supplies ran out. Officers worried about discipline as some men showed manic behavior. A memo from the Wehrmacht Medical Office in late 1940 advised restricting Pervitin to emergency situations, warning of nervous collapse and dependence. But the warning came too late. The drug was embedded in doctrine. The army had marched on chemistry and won. Success drowned out caution, and so, The pill became part of the kit, as familiar as bread and bullets. By the end of 1940, both Axis and Allies had introduced stimulants to their militaries. Millions of men were fighting, flying, and marching with chemistry in their veins. But stimulants were only the beginning. On the battlefield, soldiers would soon rely on morphine to survive wounds, barbiturates to sleep, and a host of mixtures in between. And in the shadows, Nazi doctors were already imagining even stronger cocktails for enhanced performance. The pill had proven its worth. Now the question was, how far would militaries go? The answer would unfold in the years 1941 to 1942, in the vast landscapes of Russia, in the skies over Britain, and in the desert sands of North Africa. Soldiers would discover both the power and the peril of living on pills. And that's where we turn next, to the frontline lives shaped by chemistry and the micro scenes of war fought on borrowed stamina. On paper, the German soldier of 1940 was a model of discipline, iron will, mechanical precision, tireless stamina. On the ground, the truth was stranger. Inside his tunic pocket rattled a small vial of tablets, white, chalky, stamped with a T for Temla. They looked harmless, they felt miraculous, and they changed everything about how soldiers fought, marched, and even thought. Take the infantry divisions crossing Belgium in May 1940. Their task was impossible by traditional standards, to keep pace with armored columns rolling day and night through the Ardennes. Foot soldiers should have lagged miles behind. Instead, diaries tell of men marching until their boots disintegrated, their eyes glassy, but their legs still moving. One soldier wrote to his parents, "We marched for 2 nights without sleep. We felt no hunger, no fear. It was as if time itself had stopped." Another recalled suddenly realizing he had covered more than 60 kilometers, but could barely remember the roads he had walked. "It was like being in a dream," he said. "You just keep going." For commanders, this was gold. Blitzkrieg relied on speed, and speed required men who could march like machines. Pervitin delivered exactly that. Above the battlefield, pilots fought their own war with fatigue. The Luftwaffe's missions often required flying for 10 or 12 hours, navigating in darkness, dodging anti-aircraft fire, and diving on targets with split-second precision. Here, stimulants became survival tools. Fighter pilot Peter Riedel recalled being issued Stuka-Tabletten before long missions. Some swore by them, claiming sharper focus and endless stamina. But others described unsettling effects, paranoia, tunnel vision, or hallucinations of enemy planes where none existed. British pilots in the Royal Air Force faced similar strains. During the Battle of Britain in 1940, some were given Benzedrine before night patrols. One recalled, "At first, it felt as though I could go on forever. Then, suddenly, nothing, like falling off a cliff. The stimulant kept them in the air, but when it wore off, crashes were literal as well as figurative. A pilot who nodded off on landing endangered not only himself, but his entire squadron. For the Allies, nowhere was drug use more systematic than in bomber crews. From 1941 onwards, the Royal Air Force and, later, the US Army Air Forces sent men on missions that lasted 8, 10, even 12 hours. They flew through freezing darkness, sitting in unpressurized cabins at altitudes where oxygen was scarce, steering heavy machines across enemy skies. Commanders worried less about long-term health and more about immediate performance. Benzedrine was issued as a matter of routine. By 1942, the U.S. Army Air Force had distributed over 15 million tablets to its crews. Crew members reported that the drug dulled fear and sharpened vigilance. "You didn't think about flak or night fighters," one gunner recalled. "You just kept your eyes open and your finger on the trigger." But the side effects were hard to ignore. Irritability often led to fights among crew. Decision-making grew reckless, One bomber navigator described how, midway through a raid on Hamburg, he became convinced they were off course by hundreds of miles. In reality, they were on track. His overconfidence nearly doomed the mission. The pills bought alertness, but at the cost of judgment. On the ground, another drug shaped the war experience: morphine. Every German, British, and American medic carried auto-injectors or syringes. For the wounded soldier, it was salvation. A single injection could dull agony long enough to survive evacuation. In the chaos of battle, morphine was almost miraculous. Men with shattered limbs or burns that would have driven them mad were instead calmed enough to wait for stretchers. Many veterans later recalled the moment of relief as morphine washed over like a warm tide. But the drug had its own dark side. Some soldiers became dependent after repeated doses. In occupied Europe, black markets thrived, with morphine siphoned from military stockpiles to civilians or deserters. The line between medical relief and recreational escape blurred. And unlike stimulants, which could be disguised as efficiency tools, morphine was openly addictive. Commanders tolerated it only because the alternative, untreated agony, was unthinkable. When Germany turned east in June 1941 with Operation Barbarossa, the scale of stimulant use grew even larger. Marching across vast Russian landscapes required superhuman endurance. Pervitin was distributed widely. Soldiers described marching until collapse, waking up in ditches, then swallowing another pill to rejoin the advance. Some experienced psychotic breaks. German military doctors reported men seeing entire Russian battalions where there were none, firing wildly into empty fields. Others grew paranoid, convinced comrades were plotting against them. Yet for weeks, the advance continued. Blitzkrieg again seemed unstoppable, fueled in part by pills. The Soviets themselves did not industrialize methamphetamine production on Germany's scale. Relying primarily on alcohol and caffeine as stimulants, with limited use of captured German Pervitin stockpiles later in the war. Soviet doctors also used morphine for wounded soldiers, though chronic shortages often left many untreated, forcing reliance on less effective pain management methods. Meanwhile, in North Africa, British and Commonwealth troops faced another extreme: the heat, monotony, and exhaustion of desert warfare. Here, Benzedrine became a standard issue. Australian and New Zealand units, fighting long campaigns in open desert, relied on it to endure night marches and sudden battles. But reports echoed the same warnings as Europe: soldiers snapping at comrades, falling into sudden stupors after missions, or suffering heart palpitations. Commanders quietly noted that the drug's after effects could be as dangerous as fatigue itself. By 1942, the pattern was clear across all fronts. Pills created temporary super soldiers: no sleep, no hunger, no fear. But then came the crash: sudden exhaustion, depression, paranoia, or dependence. In the short term, victories looked effortless. In the long term, cracks spread through armies. One British officer summed it up in a report: "The soldier under stimulant is brave, but he is not wise." By the midpoint of the war, militaries on both sides had locked themselves into a cycle. Commanders planned operations assuming soldiers could go without sleep. Pilots were scheduled for missions back to back, their stamina artificially extended. Logistics chains included pills as routinely as ammunition. Armies had grown chemically dependent. Without the pills, the tempo of operations seemed impossible. This dependency set the stage for darker turns. In Germany, SS doctors began experimenting with new mixtures: methamphetamine with cocaine, morphine with scopolamine. In the concentration camps, prisoners would become the unwilling test subjects for these combat enhancers. And at the very top of the Nazi regime, Hitler himself was beginning to rely on a private pharmacy of injections. The frontline soldier had shown what chemistry could do. Now the machinery of the state would push further, crossing lines between medicine, enhancement, and atrocity. The battlefield had proven the pill's power. The camps would reveal its cruelty. Far from the battlefront, another kind of war unfolded. One hidden behind barbed wire, guard towers, and euphemisms like protective custody. Inside the Nazi concentration camp system, drugs were no longer tools of endurance. They became tools of control, coercion, and cruelty. By 1941, pervitin had already proven itself on the battlefield. But the SS and Nazi medical establishment saw another use. Experiments. Camps like Dachau, Sachsenhausen, and Auschwitz doubled as laboratories. Prisoners were not patients. They were test subjects, stripped of choice, used in pursuit of research that was both pseudo-scientific and merciless. One of the earliest experiments involved methamphetamine itself. SS doctors wanted to know just how far the human body could be pushed. At Sachsenhausen, prisoners were forced to swallow high doses of pervitin before being driven to march in heavy boots across parade grounds for hours. Some collapsed and were beaten until they rose again. Others were left to die when their bodies gave out. Notes were taken dispassionately, as if cataloging mechanical failures. Another program tested cocaine-based chewing gum. The idea was chillingly practical. To create a stimulant that submarine crews could chew endlessly, staying awake for days in cramped U-boats. Inmates were ordered to chew the gum, then perform exhausting drills in freezing conditions. The results, hallucinations, collapse, organ failure, were recorded while human suffering was treated as data. If stimulants tested endurance, sedatives enforced obedience. Barbiturates and other tranquilizers were injected into prisoners to render them docile during interrogations or medical procedures. In some cases, sedatives were used as tools of execution, large doses administered to children or disabled prisoners under the so-called euthanasia programs, which aimed to eliminate those deemed unfit by the regime. The chemistry was clinical, but the effect was annihilation. Reports used bureaucratic language, administered, terminated, recorded. Behind those words lay shattered families, silenced lives. By 1943, SS doctors were also experimenting with mescaline, a hallucinogen derived from the peyote cactus. At Dachau, prisoners were secretly dosed during interrogations. Doctors observed whether the altered mental state loosened secrets. Some prisoners became confused, disoriented, or terrified, unable to distinguish hallucinations from reality. Others suffered breakdowns that never healed. These were not isolated curiosities. They reflected a systematic effort to weaponize chemistry for domination, bending minds and bodies to the will of the SS. What makes these experiments most chilling is not just the suffering, but the tone of the records. Surviving documents describe Subject A displayed accelerated pulse rate, or Subject B collapsed after 120 minutes. No mention of names, no acknowledgement of humanity. Victims were reduced to entries in a chart, their pain flattened into clinical shorthand. This coldness reveals how ideology and chemistry intertwined. The Nazi worldview already dehumanized Jews, Roma, disabled people, and political prisoners. Drugs became the accelerant that allowed doctors to treat humans as raw material. Meanwhile, outside the camps, SS doctors pursued their own concoctions for frontline use. By 1943, one project combined cocaine, methamphetamine, and oxycodone into a single super pill. It was tested on prisoners who were ordered to march in freezing weather carrying heavy loads until they collapsed. The formula was intended for tank crews expected to fight days without rest. This was the military-industrial logic of the Third Reich. To search for chemical shortcuts that turned men into tireless machines, no matter the cost to those forced to prove it. The irony is stark. Nazi propaganda exalted racial purity, natural strength, and the superiority of willpower. Yet behind the slogans, the regime leaned heavily on chemicals, not only for its soldiers, but for its experiments. Purity was ideology. Dependence was reality. The small white pill that let German soldiers storm across France was the same pill that SS doctors forced down the throats of prisoners in Sachsenhausen. The regime that preached invincibility was addicted to chemistry. For prisoners, the toll was immense. Survivors recalled trembling, sleepless nights after forced stimulant doses. Others described the terror of being injected with unknown substances, never told what they were, only to feel their hearts race or their minds fracture. Few lived long enough to testify. Most experiments ended in death, whether through overdose, exhaustion, or execution, once the data had been collected. This is the part of the drug story seldom told, that what seemed miraculous on the battlefield was monstrous in the camps. The same science that gave German soldiers energy gave prisoners torment. These atrocities were not isolated from the larger Nazi medical project. They intersected with programs like Action T4, the euthanasia campaign that killed tens of thousands of disabled Germans, often by lethal injection. They intersected with research into sterilization chemicals, used to render women infertile against their will. Chemistry was woven into genocide. By 1943, the SS had moved beyond simple pills to a philosophy of medicalized violence, using drugs, injections, and laboratory methods to enforce ideological goals. As the war dragged on, reports of addiction and collapse among German soldiers mounted. But in the camps, experiments continued. Even as the Reich began to falter on the battlefield, doctors pursued ever more desperate mixtures, hoping for a chemical miracle that would reverse the tide. It never came. What remained instead was a trail of suffering, carefully documented in notebooks, but at an immeasurable human cost. And yet, the story of drugs in the camps connects to another arena, the highest levels of Nazi leadership. Adolf Hitler himself was becoming increasingly dependent on daily injections from his personal doctor, Theodor Morell. The same regime that used drugs to torment prisoners was dosing its own leader with a private pharmacy. The contradiction is jarring, but it underscores the core theme. Chemistry was never neutral in the Third Reich. It was molded to serve power, whether through tanks, camps, or the veins of the dictator himself. The camps revealed the cruelty of chemical dependence. The Führer's inner circle would reveal its delusions. At the center of the Third Reich stood a man who preached willpower as the highest virtue. Adolf Hitler told his people that strength came from blood, discipline, and belief. He mocked weakness, despised illness, and celebrated self-control. Yet behind closed doors, the dictator relied increasingly on daily injections, pills, and chemical mixtures prepared by one man, Dr. Theodor Morell. Morell entered Hitler's life in 1936, introduced through mutual acquaintances in Berlin's elite circles. A portly, eccentric physician with a reputation for unconventional treatments, Morell was no ordinary doctor. He specialized in gastrointestinal complaints and alternative therapies, mixing vitamins, hormones, and proprietary tonics into an arsenal of injections. Hitler, plagued by chronic stomach cramps, eczema, and exhaustion, agreed to try his methods. Within days, he reported improvement. Grateful, he made Morell his personal physician. Soon, Morell had near constant access to the Führer, becoming one of the few people Hitler trusted absolutely. From the late 1930s onward, Hitler's daily routine increasingly included injections administered by Morell. At first, these were mostly vitamins, glucose, and laxatives. But as the years went on, the formulas grew stronger. One compound was Eucodal, a powerful opioid similar to oxycodone. Morell also introduced methamphetamine-based stimulants and animal-derived extracts marketed as rejuvenators. Hitler, who distrusted many in his inner circle, came to rely on Morell's syringes as a source of relief and energy. By 1941, Hitler was receiving multiple injections per day. His valet, Heinz Linger, later recalled, "The doctor came with his case morning and night. There was always a needle. Eyewitnesses noticed changes. Hitler's moods became erratic, euphoric bursts of confidence followed by periods of irritability or lethargy. His hands trembled more noticeably. He grew restless in meetings, sometimes ranting for hours without pause, other times slumping in silence." British intelligence analysts piecing together reports speculated that the Führer might be under the influence of stimulants. They were closer to the truth than they realized. Inside Germany, however, no one dared challenge Morell. He was ridiculed behind his back as the Reich quack, but Hitler defended him fiercely. To criticize Morell was to risk Hitler's wrath. Historians have long debated how much Hitler's drug use influenced his military decisions. While direct causation is impossible to prove, the timing raises questions. During the invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941, Hitler insisted on rapid advances, convinced his forces could crush Russia before winter. Reports suggest he was receiving daily stimulants during this period, which may have fueled overconfidence, though his ideological rigidity and strategic miscalculations were also significant factors. When generals urged retreats in late 1941, Hitler refused, insisting the army stand firm despite catastrophic losses. Some contemporaries speculated that his altered state contributed to his obstinacy, but other influences, like his distrust of his generals, played a major role. By 1942 and 1943, as defeats mounted at Stalingrad and in North Africa, Hitler appeared increasingly detached from reality. Visitors noted his pallor, his trembling hands, his bursts of manic energy. Each episode was followed by Morell arriving with another syringe. One staff officer later recalled, "We knew when the injection had come. The Führer's eyes lit up. His voice grew stronger, and for a few hours, he seemed himself again." Morell's notes, recovered after the war, list dozens of substances Hitler consumed. Barbiturates, bromides, atropine, strychnine, amphetamines, opiates, and testosterone derivatives. He also injected animal organ extracts, liver, bull semen, even pulverized testicles, marketed as rejuvenation therapies. By 1944, Hitler's dependency was total. He demanded Morell accompany him everywhere, even into the bomb-proof Führer bunker as Allied forces closed in. Supplies of certain drugs dwindled under bombing raids, forcing substitutions. Morell scrambled to maintain his regimen, sometimes improvising with untested mixtures. Photographs from 1944 to 45 show a man visibly deteriorating. Hitler's posture hunched, his skin waxy, his left hand trembling uncontrollably. Visitors described him as prematurely aged, alternating between bursts of megalomania and hollow fatigue. When the July 20th, 1944 assassination attempt left him injured, Morell pumped him with morphine and stimulants to dull pain and restore his energy. Within hours, Hitler was addressing the nation, his voice trembling with fury. Chemistry had stitched him back together temporarily, but the cracks were undeniable. Why did Hitler trust Morell so completely? Partly because Morell delivered what Hitler craved: immediate relief. The dictator hated illness, saw weakness as shameful, and demanded constant activity. Morell's injections let him maintain the illusion of invincibility, even as his body crumbled. But dependence also bred isolation. By late 1944, some generals tried to warn Hitler that Morell's treatments were dangerous. He ignored them. When Albert Speer, the armaments minister, expressed concern, Hitler snapped, "If I dismissed Morell, I would die." By April 1945, with Soviet troops closing in on Berlin, Morell's supplies ran out. In the underground Führer bunker, Hitler grew weaker by the day. Witnesses described him shuffling through corridors, barely able to stand, his hands shaking violently. When Morell was finally dismissed, partly out of paranoia, partly because he could no longer provide what Hitler demanded, Hitler deteriorated rapidly. The scaffolding of chemicals that had propped him up was gone. On April 30th, 1945, Hitler took his own life in the bunker. By then, his body was a shell of the man who once dominated Europe. The drugs had not created his ideology, nor his crimes, but they had sustained his delusions, prolonged his defiance, and masked his decline. Hitler's chemical dependence exposes the central contradiction of the Nazi regime. Outwardly, it exalted purity, strength, and willpower. Inwardly, its leader was kept alive by daily injections, his veins carrying a cocktail of stimulants and narcotics. The man who scorned weakness was addicted. The man who preached purity relied on animal extracts and opiates. The empire that promised invincibility was collapsing under the weight of its own illusions. And if drugs could cloud the judgment of a dictator, they could also unravel the discipline of entire armies. For even as Hitler deteriorated in his bunker, German soldiers across Europe were experiencing their own chemical collapse, addicted, exhausted, and disillusioned. That unraveling is where the story goes next. By 1943, the miracle of the pill was fading. What had once looked like an unstoppable advantage, soldiers marching without sleep, pilots flying without fear, now revealed its costs. Addiction, exhaustion, and chemical breakdown spread through the ranks of both Axis and Allied forces. Blitzkrieg had run on chemistry, but chemistry, like any fuel, burned out. On the vast plains of Russia, German troops were paying the price of their earlier dependence. In 1941, Pervitin had powered the relentless push toward Moscow. By 1943, during the retreats from Stalingrad and Kursk, supplies faltered. Soldiers who had grown accustomed to pills found themselves without them. Diaries from the front speak of collapse. One soldier wrote, "My body demands the tablets. Without them, my hands shake, my eyes close, my thoughts turn dark." Another confessed to seeing Russian soldiers in the trees where there were none. Hallucinations born of withdrawal. Field doctors reported mass cases of depression and psychosis. Some men wandered aimlessly, refusing orders. Others collapsed mid-march, unable to move. What had once made them tireless now made them useless. German medical officers recognized the crisis. A confidential 1943 memo from the Wehrmacht Medical Office warned, "The remedy has become a liability. Dependency among troops is widespread. Use should be restricted." But restrictions were impossible. The army's strategy still assumed sleepless marches and relentless offensives. Without pills, the doctrine itself unraveled. Commanders quietly ignored the warnings and continued distribution. Addiction was tolerated as the cost of war. Pilots, too, began to suffer. By 1944, Luftwaffe airmen were flying fewer sorties but under harsher conditions. Stimulants kept them awake, but crashes grew deadlier. Some pilots reported blacking out mid-flight after sudden exhaustion. Others grew paranoid, firing at shadows or breaking formation in a panic. One medical report described a squadron returning from a mission with three planes lost. Not to enemy fire, but to accidents linked to stimulant overuse and fatigue. The miracle pill was undermining the very force it was meant to empower. Across the lines, the Allies faced their own stimulant crises. By 1943, the U.S. Army had distributed tens of millions of benzedrine tablets. In the 8th Air Force alone, long-range bomber crews routinely swallowed pills before missions. The symptoms mirrored the German experience. Soldiers grew irritable, quarrelsome, or reckless. One American bomber navigator later recalled, "We thought we were sharper. In truth, we were making mistakes faster." British reports echoed the concern. An RAF medical officer wrote, "Benzedrine maintains wakefulness but impairs judgment. Its tactical use may be justified, but its habitual use is dangerous." Yet missions continued, and so did the pills. The machinery of total war demanded performance, even if the human parts broke down. Alongside stimulants, morphine left deep scars. By 1944, hundreds of thousands of wounded soldiers had received injections. Many recovered physically, but some carried an invisible wound, dependency. In Germany, veterans returned from the front secretly addicted. In the United States and Britain, some injured servicemen quietly struggled to wean themselves off the drug that had once saved them. Military hospitals often lacked resources to treat these cases, and stigma kept many silent. In occupied territories, morphine and pervitin flooded black markets. Civilians traded rations for pills. In bombed-out Berlin, morphine became an escape from despair. What had been medicine on the battlefield became a commodity of survival and destruction at home. As chemical dependence spread, military discipline eroded. German officers reported men disobeying orders in manic fits or slumping into depressive stupors. American commanders noted airmen refusing missions without their Benzedrine. Addiction was undermining command authority. There were accidents too. Trucks overturned when exhausted drivers blacked out after stimulant crashes. Ammunition dumps exploded after inattentive guards, jittery from pills, mishandled weapons. The cost was measured not only in health, but in lost materiel and lives. By late 1944, both German and Allied medical corps had compiled evidence of the dangers. Reports listed heart failure, psychosis, violent outbursts, and suicides. Recommendations urged limiting stimulants to emergencies only. But in practice, the war machine could not slow down. Generals ordered offensives, pilots flew missions, soldiers marched. Pills remained part of the kit. Science was overruled by strategy. The toll on individual soldiers was devastating. Letters home from 1944 and 1945 carry a different tone from the brash confidence of 1940. Men wrote of despair, sleeplessness, and craving. "I cannot close my eyes without them," one German soldier confessed about Pervitin. An American airman admitted, "We are fighting the war twice, once against the enemy, once against our own nerves." Even for those who survived, the legacy lingered. Veterans returned with nervous disorders, heart problems, or lingering dependency. Some carried these scars quietly for decades. By the final months of the war, the chemical scaffolding was crumbling alongside the Reich itself. Hitler, deprived of Morell's injections, deteriorated visibly in the bunker. German troops, starving and undersupplied, no longer had access to steady pill rations. The machine men of 1940 were gone. What remained were exhausted, broken bodies. For the Allies, stimulants kept operations running through the final offensives of 1944 to 45, but medics noted rising cases of breakdowns, both physical and psychological. Victory came, but the human cost extended beyond the battlefield. The pattern was clear. Stimulants had given armies speed, but also dependency. Morphine had given relief, but also addiction. The drugs were accelerants, not solutions. They burned brightly, then left ashes. When the supply faltered, so did the soldiers. When the pills stopped working, so did the doctrine. The miracle of 1940 ended in the rubble of 1945. The war would end in May 1945. But the chemistry would not. Stockpiles of stimulants flooded post-war societies. Veterans carried their dependencies into civilian life, and militaries quietly kept their lessons, preparing to use stimulants again in future conflicts. The crash of 1945 was not the end. It was the beginning of a new chapter one where wartime drugs shape peace, medicine, and even future wars. That afterlife is where the story goes next. Into the post-war years, the Cold War, and the echoes that still haunt us today. May 1945. The guns fell silent. The flags of surrender were signed. But the chemistry of war did not vanish with the rubble of Berlin and Tokyo. Pills and powders lingered in barracks, warehouses, and black markets. Soldiers carried their habits home. Doctors adapted wartime formulas into peacetime prescriptions, and governments quietly filed away their knowledge for the next conflict. The Second World War had been a laboratory on a global scale. Its experiments did not end with peace. They echoed into the Cold War, civilian medicine, and even our present-day understanding of drugs. Nowhere was the post-war echo louder than in Japan. The Imperial military had stockpiled vast quantities of methamphetamine, marketed under the trade name Philopon. With defeat, those stores spilled into civilian life. By 1946, Philopon was sold openly in pharmacies as a pick-me-up for exhausted workers in a devastated economy. The results were catastrophic. By 1950, Japan faced a nationwide meth epidemic. Hundreds of thousands were addicted. Crime rose. Families collapsed under the strain. Only after strict government bans and arrests in the mid-1950s did the epidemic begin to recede. But the scars, social and medical, remained for decades. In Germany, Pervitin never truly disappeared. Although Allied occupation authorities tried to restrict its production, the drug persisted in underground markets. War veterans, traumatized and displaced, sought escape in familiar tablets. For some, Pervitin was easier to find than food. Even in the new West German Bundeswehr, stimulants made occasional appearances in training and planning, though never on the same mass scale as the Wehrmacht. Memories of dependency lingered too vividly. In the United States, wartime Benzedrine found a smoother transition. It remained legal, prescribed for depression, obesity, and fatigue. Post-war America, obsessed with productivity and modern efficiency, embraced the pep pill culture. By the 1950s, truck drivers, students, and housewives all had access to amphetamines. Pharmaceutical companies rebranded them as safe, effective aids for the modern lifestyle. The military also continued their use. In Korea, US pilots were issued Benzedrine as standard kit. In Vietnam, the pills returned in force, this time as Dexedrine, a more potent variant. Between 1966 and 1969, American forces consumed an estimated 225 million stimulant tablets. The lesson of World War II, that stimulants could keep an army awake and aggressive, had not been forgotten. The Soviet Union, too, learned from wartime chemistry. While it never industrialized methamphetamine on the German scale, it relied heavily on alcohol, morphine, and later, amphetamines. Cold War military manuals described stimulants as tools for prolonged combat readiness. The same pattern repeated, promises of superhuman stamina followed by hidden costs. Not all legacies were destructive. Some wartime drugs evolved into legitimate medical treatments. Amphetamines, despite their misuse, became the foundation for therapies treating attention deficit disorders. Morphine, long known as addictive, remained indispensable in controlled medical settings for pain relief. The difference between medicine and weapon was not the chemical itself, but the purpose and the scale. In war, pills were distributed by the millions, often without regard for side effects. In medicine, careful dosages and monitoring allowed real benefits, but the blurred line remains. Modern debates about stimulant medications carry echoes of the 1940s, when doctors first promised that chemistry could make men tireless, focused, and obedient. After 1945, nations struggled with how to classify and control these substances. Methamphetamine was gradually banned or tightly restricted across Europe and Japan. Amphetamines, however, remained widely prescribed well into the 1960s before abuse forced tighter controls. Culturally, the memory of wartime drugs was often suppressed. Veterans rarely spoke about the pills. Nations preferred to tell stories of courage, sacrifice, and technology, not of chemistry. The myth of the tireless soldier was easier to digest than the reality of medicated armies. Only decades later did historians uncover the full scale through archives and testimony. What, then, is the legacy of wartime drugs? First, they reveal how easily science can be bent to ideology. A pill that began as a housewife's helper became a weapon of blitzkrieg. A sedative meant to calm patients became a tool of extermination in the camps. A stimulant that kept pilots awake also led them to hallucinate and crash. Second, they remind us that drugs are accelerants, not causes. Methamphetamine did not invent fascism, nor did Benzedrine win the war for the Allies. But both stripped away natural limits, fatigue, fear, hesitation, making violence easier and collapse faster. Finally, they challenged the myth of purity. The Nazis preached racial strength and natural superiority, yet their soldiers and leaders were propped up by chemicals. The Allies claimed moral high ground, yet also fed their crews millions of pills. No side was immune to the temptation of chemical shortcuts. Even in the 21st century, the echoes remain. Modern militaries still issue stimulants for long missions, though under tighter medical supervision. In Afghanistan and Iraq, US pilots received go pills, usually modafinil, to maintain alertness. The ethical debates are ongoing. Do such pills enhance safety by reducing fatigue, or do they mask exhaustion and invite disaster? In civilian life, prescription stimulants are common for medical conditions. Used properly, they can be transformative. Misused, they repeat the old pattern of dependence and crash. The story that began in the laboratories of the 1930s is not over. It continues in new forms, with new names. By 1945, the world had seen how far a pill could push human limits. It had also seen the price: addiction, accidents, atrocities, and a legacy of mistrust. The chemistry of World War II reminds us that technology, however small, is never neutral. It carries the values of those who wield it. And in the crucible of total war, values were bent to speed, control, and domination. When the regime fell, the chemistry didn't. It seeped into peacetime, shaping medicine, militaries, and societies for generations. So what is the takeaway? It is not that drugs cause the war, nor that they explain its atrocities. It is that drugs acted as accelerants, stripping away the last barriers between ideology and action. They made it easier to obey, easier to endure, easier to destroy. And they left behind broken bodies, broken minds, and broken societies. The story of drugs in World War II is ultimately a story about humanity's relationship with limits. Fatigue, pain, and fear are not just weaknesses. They are warnings, breaks, reminders of our mortality. To erase them with chemistry is to risk losing the balance that keeps us human. In 1940, a pill turned soldiers into machines. For a while. By 1945, the same pill left them addicted, broken, or dead. The miracle was temporary. The cost was permanent. Today, as new drugs promise sharper focus, longer wakefulness, and enhanced performance, the echo of that history should give us pause. Science can be medicine. It can also be a weapon. The difference lies in the values we attach to it. World War II showed us what happens when chemistry serves ideology. It turned pills into accelerants of hate. It sustained delusions of invincibility, and it left scars that have not fully healed. Drugs didn't invent hate. They only removed the last friction that slowed it down. That is the lesson of the war. And its echo is still with us. If this story moved you, challenged you, or helped you see the Second World War differently, it would be an honor to have you join our growing community. Subscribing isn't just a click. It's a way to support more powerful stories, more forgotten voices, and more truth from the past. So if you believe these stories matter, hit that subscribe button and let's keep building this journey together. And don't forget to leave a comment. We read everyone and love hearing your thoughts. Until next time, keep exploring history with Epic War. Keep asking questions. Keep seeking the truth.